pandemic got us into a reflective space and made us look inward to see what we can do for the world at large. As a self-expression coach, I became a catalyst for women and started Vani, a one-on-one coaching program for women on finding their voice, to speak up, to be visible. As a storyteller, I spotted there were many ordinary people amongst us leading extraordinary lives, making a difference to the world, and they needed to be heard. Thus was born You and I with Rashmi Shetty, where amazing personal journeys with their uniqueness and individuality are showcased. A reaffirmation of the fact, open your eyes wider, the world is far more beautiful when we acknowledge the presence of both you and I. Our guest today is Mukesh Sharma, the co-founder and managing director of Mentera. Through the Mentera Social Impact Fund, he invests in social enterprises that are harnessing the power of technology to impact India by improving the quality of farming, healthcare, and education. Mukesh has over 20 years of experience in startup investing, impact investing, private equity, investment banking, and the finance domains. A chartered accountant and a CFA charter holder, he has been a member of the Capital Subcommittee of the Impact Investors Council India. He's also a member of the Polestar Award jury, which is focused on celebrating excellence in journalism and social impact. Mukesh believes that non-linear outcomes are more likely to be achieved through big game-changing ideas that leverage the latest science and technology. He's focused on using the power of technology to solve the most pressing developmental challenges. Mukesh has co-founded his platform and has attracted a stellar network of advisors and the best impact-oriented talent. He is now working on scaling this model to generate market-level returns and sectoral impact. Listen in as Mukesh shares his inspirational journey from a small town in Gujarat to the investor that he is today. Hi, Mukesh. Such a pleasure having you on You and I with Rashmi Shetty.
Hi, Rashmi. Good to connect with you. Thank you. Thank you for inviting.
My pleasure, because having gone through the little video that I saw of yours and the work that Mentera does, it made it all the more important for me to understand who you are. And before we go to the Mukesh the world knows you today as, let's start with the little Mukesh and the influences Mukesh had in his childhood. So where did you grow up and what was your childhood like?
I grew up in a small town called Gandhidham. It's in Kutch district in Gujarat. This city was built to resettle refugees of partition. So my grandfather was a refugee of partition. He came from what was Sindh on the other side of the border. So our family is from Kutch. Our origin is from Kutch. So we are Kutchis. But there is, you know, some, you know, business trade that happened with Sindh. So he had to come back during partition. And I think probably one of the first few families which was not Sindhi, but given that, you know, given place in that city. This city was built at Gandhi's request to Maharaja of Kutch to give a, you know, parcel of land so that you can resettle refugees. So that's where I grew up. I would say it's a very interesting place. It's you know, you have desert there, you have you know, two of the major ports. Initially Kandla port, which was one of the first ports in India, is there, and then Mundra port, which was built by the Adani group later. So there are two ports on two sides of Gandhidham. So there's a lot of industrial activity that has happened because of ports. So you see timber, you see salt activity, you see lot of industrial activity. But in terms of, you know, core areas of development, education, healthcare, you will see that still, despite, you know, good economic activity, good financial wealth and all, you won't see that fully developed. Even today, you won't see it fully developed. So when I was growing up, it's a very small town, right? You could walk 15, 20 minutes in any direction and the town got over. So it was nice growing up in a small place where you pretty much knew everyone. You walk on the streets, everyone knows you, and you know everyone.
When it came to your life as a student, how were you? A topper in class, and what was your family about? What were your inspirations as a kid? What were you interested in?
I think those days we didn't used to spend that much. There was no pressure of studies or having to, you know, pass some exam or get some grades or go into some sort of, you know, IIT, IIM, all of that. So I think till at least 10th grade, till the board exam, I didn't even realize I'm studying, right? You went to school to just play with your friends. So, and most of the times we would just wait for the class to get over to run to the playground and just play. You come home and just play. You know, no pressure at all of studies, no, really no goals in life. It was nothing like, you know, you have to study to do this. Like a small town would be, right? Where the whole neighborhood seemed like your family, where, you know, which house you are eating in, where you are. I mean, all the houses, doors were open for you. Yeah, so I think once I came out of that town and when I grew up, I saw a very different world. At that time, you know, you didn't have this concept of boundaries, right? That this is your home, this is where you eat, this is what, there's no, you know, particular schedule. It was quite free life, I would say.
Yeah, and it sounds such an ideal world, Mukesh, when you're telling us and sharing a safe space for children, a wonderful camaraderie amongst the community. So every child is the child of each home that is there. So
yeah.
Obviously the vernacular was very popular. And after 10th, did you move out of Kutch? How did you get into what you're doing now? What happened post 10th standard?
Yeah, so I actually continued in the same school, same town. I did my graduation, everything. So I studied in an aided vernacular medium school, and I didn't realize how important English was till I was at least in college. And I think probably post college is when I realized that, you know, English, if I don't learn English, many of the doors are really shut for you. So I started writing my papers for the first time in college in English. Till that time, I wrote everything in Hindi. And when I graduated, I think after that, I did my CA. So even during my CA, if you asked me to speak in English, I was not confident that I would be able to communicate coherent sort of, you know, conversation for even a few minutes. And that block, I think, existed for a very long time. I still feel I have that block because when I'm talking to you, I'm not thinking in English, right? So I'm thinking in my mother tongue, I'm thinking in Hindi, and there is sort of khichdi going on in my mind, which then comes out in English. That was there. And the only reason I left my town was we had massive earthquake in 2005. So at that point in time, I was doing my CA, I was in CA final. Part of my house also collapsed, and I had to continue my studies. And there were some people who helped me really, you know, leave the town and go and live in Baroda for a month and then go to Pune for a few months. I got a lot of support from community, chartered accountants who wanted to help people, students who were affected in earthquake. I had an extended family that helped me. So I eventually ended up in Pune and completed my CA. And after that, I have actually not lived in Kutch. I've gone there only for a major family sort of events. But also what happened was that the school that I went to was an aided vernacular medium school, and our whole town had only one college. So no matter which school you went to, no matter which part of the, you know, strata, economic, social strata you belonged to, you all ended up in the same college. There were only three different streams, but it was under the same college administration. And that's where you all of a sudden met with people who went to convent you know, had a lot more confidence. They were more confident. They were able to, you know, articulate things better. And till that time, I didn't realize that, you know, as a student, I was so far away. Because the class that I went to had many first generation learners. My generation was the first generation into college from my family. And I had many, many such students around. So I didn't really see that gap in terms of, you know, education, exposure, you know, need for focusing on knowledge and learning. I didn't see it till I was, I think, probably second or third year of college, where someone who, a friend of mine who was from convent school and had a lot of exposure, he told me, why don't you come to Ahmedabad? I had not even gone to a large city till, right? My exposure was only to two, three small towns where the family was. And I went to Ahmedabad and all these students were talking about going to IIM. I was like, okay, what is IIM? I didn't know what it meant. IIM, IIT, XLRI, all these, you know, tier one, tier two colleges. And when they told me about it, my first impression was, hey, I should also do something like that. I started looking at their forms. I was quite intimidated. I looked at it and I said, okay, I don't even understand what is a form, all these entrance exams, how am I going to pass? Then I started thinking, is there anything where I can get in without entrance? If I work hard, I might get. So CA was, you know, one such course. There was no entrance exam. And I thought, I'm good with numbers, I'm good with accounts and all, maybe that will work for me. So that's how my education was also, you know, quite trial and error. A lot of it is incidental, accidental, and then that's how I found my way.
Okay, so you said that you studied in a vernacular aided school and you realized the need for English once you were done with your graduation. So how did you teach yourself the English language? Because today you're speaking so fluently, you have a business venture of your own. What did you do exactly to help yourself get good with English? Because that's a question that many of these youngsters that I meet in colleges that I go to ask me, because many of them come from the vernacular medium and their confidence, though they're very good in the subject, their confidence is really low. They feel because they can't speak in English, they do not come forward to answer. So if there is a bunch of students in front of you, what would you like to tell them on how to build that skill? And it's not a big thing at all to translate your thoughts, which are still in vernacular, into English while you're speaking. So how did you do that for yourself?
I don't know, like many things that I'm telling you, there was no structure to my figuring out English. But what I did was, you know, when I was growing up, my father had a small retail textile shop. And next to that was the only newspaper magazine shop in the city. There was no other place you could go to buy a magazine. To help my father, certain number of hours a day, I had to just, you know, be there when he had to run errands. I would sit there and I'd go to this magazine shop, and the person who used to manage that shop, he was very kind. He would tell me, okay, go read whatever. Though it was a shop where he sold books, it ended up being a library shop. So I would pick up. So I was used to reading newspaper from very early days. Usually I would read Gujarati newspaper. We had a newspaper called Kutch Mitra, which only talked about Kutch. Maybe there's some mention of what happened in Gujarat somewhere, in India somewhere. But then I started reading more and more newspapers. So in college, what the habit that I developed, read a Gujarati newspaper and then read English newspaper, because news is same, right? Both are talking about the same topic, so try and read that. That was one thing that I did. Those days in Doordarshan, you had Hindi news, which immediately after that there was English. So I watched that Hindi news and English news after that, and I was very fond of, you know, sports, all forms of sports, right? So we used to have cricket books, we used to have Sports Star and all, and these books also came in two different languages, not Sports Star, but a lot of cricket. So I'd read the same thing in two different languages. And there was a English commentator who used to write. His name was Geoffrey Boycott. He used to write English, which I found very difficult to understand, of course, because he was Brit. And he would pick vocabulary and language, which was not easy. So I would keep dictionary next to me and I'd underline words that I didn't understand. The first time I read, I probably didn't understand 80% of what he said. And that became my benchmark for, you know, over time, I would say, okay, how many words do I really need to refer to dictionary to understand what he's saying? And cricket as a subject, I understood, right? So I could make up some of it. But there was no one around me who could speak. I mean, no one in family spoke English. No one in neighborhood spoke English. Even if you went to a class where English was being taught, it would be a mixed language, right? So while I was able to read, you know, the confidence of being able to speak, I think took a lot of time. And that happened after I left Kutch. So when I went to Pune, I still remember my, you know, academy's director. He wanted me to speak on topic on corporate governance in the country. And I said that, look, I don't think I can come onto the stage and speak. I have to speak in English. And he gave me confidence. He said, why don't you come? I'll be standing next to you. And if you are not able to communicate, I will translate. And I thought there'll be 15, 20, 30 students. So I went to the stage and there were like some, probably at least 150, 200 people in front of me. There was first experience where I was not sure, do I want to speak? And the director just introduced me and he walked off the stage. So I had to just speak. I had no option. And I don't know how many mistakes, errors I made, but I understood the subject. I was not very conscious because of that subject. I was confident. I just kept speaking, and that was the first time where I felt that okay, I can speak probably. So there's confidence to speak, but still there is a little bit of a block. I still public speaking. Someone will have to push me to say that go and do it. Then I do it.
Okay, because this is something where you clearly are telling us it's all about practice. Just get out there, because you cannot learn swimming, for example, just reading about swimming. You have to get yourself wet to understand what swimming is all about. But taking the two steps back, Mukesh, to the earthquake that happened, that was something which was in 2001. The earthquake that you said was really devastating for Gujarat per se. And you were part of it. What, now looking back, are there some lessons that you took from that instance which you are putting into your life also?
Many lessons. I think one, it made me fearless, right? Because you see death in front of you. You see a lot of people dying in front of you, building collapsing. And so I was actually stuck middle of the road, and my house was behind me, and there was a high rise in front of me. I saw, you know, whole high rise collapse. So it made me fearless, because you know that, you know, you start believing in a lot of things. You say, okay, nothing is in your hand, right? It makes you very humble. So one, I think I don't usually, things don't bother me, that you get perspective in life, small problems, challenges. So it made me more perseverant, I think, because when problems are thrown at me, I don't walk away that easily from it. So that was one. Second, it taught me that while money is important, but there are times when money doesn't work. Because I remember, you know, my mother had a head injury and I had to take her to a hospital. We didn't have a car. And I think no amount of money would have gotten you a car on rent or that. And we finally, I got a car from a very good friend of mine, and we drove it. We're running out of petrol, and petrol pumps were not giving you petrol. And you could actually walk to them and say, look, petrol is at that time some 40, 50 rupees a liter. You know, I'll give you 400 rupees. Nobody will give you, because everybody was in the mode of conserving. Nobody knew how bad it is, what it is going to happen. And then there was a group of villagers who were having, you know, everyone kept some 1 liter reserve in a house, because they didn't live place close to where, you know, petrol was easily available. All of them pooled, and all the village reserve they gave. Right, there was just pure response to, you know, humanity, the humanitarian response, saying, okay, there is someone really needs it. And now it's not one family, the whole village is going to run out of petrol, right, till they get their next stop. But they gave it, and they gave it not because of money. So like that whole, I think there are 2-3 months where people came forward to help me to continue my studies in PA and all of that. I saw a lot of people really wanting to help. And so it helped me understand, you know, the power of relationship, network, really figuring out when someone needs help, being there to help someone. So I think some of those things stayed with me. Today, what I do, I can really pursue a career which can give me a lot of money. But I do that because of some of these experiences where, you know, that look, a lot of people who are affected, sometimes they need help, and that help, there are many ways to help people, right? So, I think those 3 or 4 things, which I think they made me a better human being, where I didn't run after, you know, materialistic things in life. Very early on, many times, you know, you in your 50s and 60s, you look back and you say, okay, how do I give back? These things happened with me when I was a student, right? So that exposure helped me. What I do, I didn't wait till my 50s. I did that in my 20s. I did that in my 30s. I didn't wait till my 50s and 60s today.
Great. Beautiful. In fact, now we'll go to what you did then to what you're doing now. So once you completed your chartered accountancy, how did life open for you? What were the opportunities? And you said you were in Pune, right, at that point of time. So what did life throw open for you?
I think it's been full of challenges. I don't think, you know, many times you believe that if you do CA, life becomes easy. It's not. It doesn't become easy, because you deal with, you know, this issue of inequality. Coming from a small town, you have no network, right? I might be in Pune, but I know no one in Pune. except for a small group of people who I studied with. But they were all still students, right? They were all trying to build their own net, their own career, their own network. So I think what I did was at that time, getting job was very difficult. I mean, the amount of money that was being offered, I wouldn't even have been able to cover my own expenses, leave aside, you know, debt and all that you would have incurred. There were many other, you know, aspirations that you have can't really fulfill. And alongside that, I figured out that while I did CA, I didn't want to be a practicing chartered accountant. You know, tax, law, I understand that well. I enjoy it. I enjoy it when I have to solve a specific problem. But I thought that, you know, I wanted to become an investor. I don't know why, but at that time, I thought investing was of interest to me. And I went to a lot of people saying, I want to do investing. But everyone would look at my CV and they'll give me accounting job, audit job. Nobody thought that, you know, I can do investing. And I didn't get the job that I wanted for almost, I would say, 6 months. I passed in May, and then I had, you know, someone in my family, extended family, she was traveling to Pune, and I went to receive her to Mumbai airport. That was the first time I went to the airport. I was looking at, you know, flights landing, taking off. I was telling myself that someday I should, you know, fly from Mumbai airport somewhere. I don't know why I got that thing. And I was driving back. This was my dad's cousin, and he was asking me, have you thought of your career so many months? What do you want to do? I said, I want to go into investing, but I'm not getting a job. And she said that maybe I can help you go abroad. Where would you like to go? Can you tell me that? I didn't know where to go. There was a, you know, one of the few times where I went into cyber cafe. The students have internet and computers at home. And I went to cyber cafe looking for where are jobs in investing. This is, I'm talking end 2001, right? Around November, December period, after 9/11. So I told her that, look, I want to go to US because US was the place where you could do it. London was the second option. She said that, look, there's no way. After 9/11, getting to US was not easy at all. Even before that, it wasn't easy, but after 9/11, it became tougher. So she said that, look, US and London, I can't, but Dubai and Hong Kong are the two places where I can help you. So then I did more research, and they were creating in Dubai International Financial Center, where they were talking about building the whole investment industry from there. I said, okay, let me go there. So I said, can you help me go to Dubai? And she helped me arrange for visa. I went to an uncle of mine, asked him for some loan for 3 months, landed up in Dubai. Crashed with a friend for 2-3 months. I said, you know, whatever rent you are paying, we'll share the rent, and started looking for job. Got a job in Dubai, and that's how my career started.
So at every point, there's somebody who came in, gave you the hand, and took you to the next level. Wow. Okay, so community has been holding your back since. And this is so beautiful. So once you went to Dubai and you started working, you were like, life set now, that's it? Because was it a job of your choice? Did you get into investment?
No, I actually didn't get a job for a month because many people they were giving me jobs were in textile shop. And again, I had someone from the family tell me that, look, don't take these type of jobs. The type of job they said, you know, go back to India, but don't take a job. Because in those days in Dubai, they used to, you know, take your passport. So you are literally a bonded labor, right? Even if you are qualified, you're a bonded labor. So unless you get a job in a good company, don't take it. And I had, you know, friends who came from the same city were working like that. And they were like, how are you rejecting all these jobs? You want to run out of money in a month's time. You have to take some job. And I said, look, I will go back unless I get a job in an MNC. And investing jobs, of course, I realized they talked about investing, but there was no investing. Then you learn that Dubai is good at marketing things before even they've done it. So the investment industry had not happened. There were very few investment jobs. But I got a job in a French company in their finance department. It was better than what a lot of my friends did. And they didn't make me a bonded labor. They didn't take my passport. It seemed like a reasonable offer to make, reasonable offer to accept. And that's how my career started. And I met with... I went to attend, you know, gathering of chartered accountants in Dubai. And there was someone from Kutch who had, you know, who learned of my story. And he sat down with me and he said, you know, why don't you come and work for me? I said, look, I want investing job. So after this, if I leave this job, I'll do it only for it. And he said, have you heard of CFA? If you do CFA, you get investing job. same evening I went home, searched for CFA, appeared, you know, applied for CFA, started doing CFA. And so morning to evening I would work, evening to late night I would study for my CFA. And once I did my level two of CFA, I got a job in it. That too, I think I must have given at least somewhere between 80 to 90, you know, interviews before I got my first investing job. So it didn't come easy, but eventually came. I just didn't give up that option.
This is relentless pursuit. Today's youngsters don't have the patience. They want everything instantly. When you look back at your journey, at a time when things were not very easy, what kept you going forward saying that, yes, let me do this? And what if after your CFA, you don't get it? You didn't even think of that eventuality, or you were so sure after CFA, you'll get the job of your choice?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think that much. I just said that, okay, if you just keep doing it, if you don't give up. Because those days, I also used to be very inspired with many quotes, with many, you know, specific things, poems, songs, and you know, they just would motivate me. So I would just, okay, if you just start it, you eventually get it.
Okay.
So
and you were alone, right, Mukesh? What was keeping you motivated? Because you're working, coming back, studying, there must be something that kept you motivated, right? It's a long day working there, and it's a hot place. You come back, you're tired, but still you push yourself to study. You're already a chartered accountant, and pushing yourself to go to the next level, and CFA exams are not very easy. So what kept you going now looking back?
Failure was not an option. I think in my mind, I realized that, and that I figured out in college when I switched from that vernacular medium school to a college, and I saw how big the gap was. And then I think probably every time in my life, I just kept having higher and higher benchmark and saw the gap and just said, okay, this is the gap that has to be filled if you just keep going at it. Also, twice I gave up, and then I realized I gave up probably too early. I just failed by a very small margin, or I didn't fail where I thought I'm going to fail. I didn't fail. First time it happened when I was in college. I was doing some software course during those days. AppTech was a, you know, computer course, and there were two exams, morning and evening. So morning I came back, I told my mother that I did so miserably that I'm going to fail and there's no point in going back for second. I got a pep talk from my mother, and she was like, you know, I don't want you to ever quit. She said, even if you fail, you pass the second exam. Even if you fail both, I don't want you to walk away. And I went, and then I was, you know, quite demoralized. I still attempted. And then I realized I scored more marks in first then second. I, of course, didn't fail in both. Scored more in first than in second. That still didn't hit home. But when I did my CA final in May after earthquake, a lot of people kept telling me that you have to pass in first attempt. Because in CA, a lot of people write on their resume that passed in first attempt. And then you get job more easily, because that's how people screen out someone who passed in first attempt. The better student. I was thinking, should I appear for the exam or not? I thought I'm not well prepared. You know, a lot of things in my mind. I'd lost my mother just, you know, a month or 2 months before because of earthquake. She was in ICU for almost a month. So a lot of things going in my background. But then, you know, I just remembered her saying that don't ever quit. And I said, okay, what the hell? Let me just go and let me see what happens. I still remember sitting in a paper. I thought I didn't really understand what was there. I thought I'm going to fail the paper, and I didn't attempt half of it. And I just walked away. And I failed by some 2 or 3 marks. And if I had actually attempted the full paper, I would have probably passed that exam. So that was the time when I realized that, you know, don't quit. And then that stayed with me all throughout life, right? Because now you're not first attempt pass, you don't get job because you can't write first attempt just because you gave up. So a lot of these things happen where you learn from that, saying, okay, many times you quit mentally, right? You have the ability to do it, but mentally you gave up. So I think I still give up mentally sometimes, but then I motivate myself to again go at it second time. I failed in CFA also, by the way. I failed in CA. So everywhere I think I fail once, and then I go at it again second, third time again. Investment job, same thing. My firm I wanted to start, same thing. I think everything in my life I get second or third attempt. I don't get it in first attempt, but I get it.
But I think that makes it that much more powerful when you get it eventually, because you're not giving up. So every time you look back in your journey so far, at least, you've not given up because you didn't get it in the first attempt. You were relentless in that pursuit. So now that you cleared your CFA and then you got a job, was it an investment job that you got after CFA in Dubai itself? Or
So
how did your journey
after
go?
yeah, so after like first, like I said, this French company 2.5 years, and then after that, after 80, 90 attempts, I got my first investment job. That I think was one of the best phases of my life, because I still remember first 2, 3 years. I was like whole day just working, reading, including weekends, because I wanted to learn everything about it. I had few good mentors around. They were voracious readers. My first company, I had four partners in this investment company. They came from JP Morgan, Geneva, and JP Morgan, New York. So they had good training. So I was analyst reporting to four partners, all four very different personalities. We were investing in Kurdistan and Iraq post-war reconstruction team. We were investing in Romania pre-EU integration, investing in Ukraine, looked at Afghanistan, Turkey. I mean, you learn geopolitics, you learn economics, you learn, I mean, many of these flashpoints that I had not even known. Growing up, I thought India, Pakistan is the worst thing in the world, till you figure out, you know, Israel-Palestine issue, till you figure out many of the other flashpoints in the world. And in Dubai, I made friends who were from Pakistan, and from Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, friends who were Syrian, Palestinian. You realize Shia and Sunni, you have heard of caste in India. You thought that, you know, religious differences, then you figure out. But Dubai was a melting pot for me. I met so many people. At one point in one company with like 25, 30 probably employees, 18 nationalities. You talk to them, and I think that exposure was amazing. I enjoyed, you know, learning about different cultures, different religions, different people. It's a great experience.
The beauty about this experience is it shapes your thought process.
Yeah, that's
So,
right.
with these thought processes, did you stay on in Dubai for a long time, or did you come back to India wanting to now start your dream venture?
I was in Dubai for 8 years, so it was a pretty long stint and met with a lot of people. And that's why I think if it was a short stint, I wouldn't have gotten the experiences that I got. But I think because it was as long as it was, I think that really helped.
And after 8 years, why did you decide to come back to India? I'm sure by 8 years you must have settled down and things must have been really good for you, right?
I don't think I'm ever settled down. I'm always looking for a next challenge in life. But by the time our daughter was born, and she was about to start school, and I was changing few jobs, both of us felt that if we didn't move now, if our daughter started getting comfortable before she starts school and all, we didn't want to disrupt everything for her. And we really wanted her to grow up in India. I wanted to come back to India, and this dream of, you know, solving issues of education, healthcare in India, that was always there. I still remember I would go to my office. I might be investing in Europe or in Africa or in Middle East, but first thing I would open up is what's happened in India, right? Economic issues, social issues, political issues, Indian companies, Indian stock market. So that told me that, you know, I'm not even doing anything about India, but I'm so involved. So it was pulling me. It was pulling me back. I met with my wife's grandfather. He was 90, I think about 90 plus, and I mean, extraordinary human being, taught in Sangli, Walsall College of Engineering. So my first meeting with him, he just kept asking that, why are you in Dubai? Why are you not back in India? I said, I'll come at some point. He said, when will that come? That has to happen now. Why is that, you know, future? And what you are doing in Dubai that you can't do anything? And I talked to him about money and all, and he said, how much money do you really need? And there was a good question that, how much money do you really need? And he said, now give up all this insecurity, right? That you won't get what you want in India. Because that was also worrying me, that I didn't get job for several months, right? I had to go to Dubai to what I. So then he said, look, I think now you are comfortable in your life. You've got enough exposure, enough experience, enough skills. Just come back. And we still took a couple of years, but you know, every year we would have this discussion. Every time we would come for vacations, we would want to come back. Coming back was also not very easy, right? When you came back, everyone said, you've never worked in India. Like, what do you know about Indian, you know, regulations? You might be chartered accountant. It just changed. So again, I didn't get job. When I came back to India, people were like, you're coming from Dubai and you know nothing about Indian. Yeah, it was, coming back was also not easy, and adjusting back to India was also.
Okay, so what did you do? How okay, you nothing worked here. Didn't you feel like just packing and going back to Dubai? Or was
That
it
thought,
like, no, I'm
that
going to
that
start something?
no, that thought came a couple of times, and also I had so many friends, bosses from Dubai who kept calling me back saying, you know, what are you doing with your life? Come back. You know, every few months you'll have someone making an offer to you saying, come back. I think there was a moment where I felt that I should go back, because for several months nothing was working out. No really good options emerging. Coming back to India, also trying to adjust because my whole working life was there, and you got used to very different way of living. A lot more. Dubai is a very, you know, luxurious place. It's a ivory tower that you sit in, right? It's not real. Dubai is not real. India was real again. It took a couple of years to settle down, and I think I met with a number of innovators and entrepreneurs who were solving problems. I met two, three of them who really inspired me, saying, okay, maybe this is a journey that I should give more time to. I said, okay, whatever my goals for a few years, if I don't achieve, you know, then I'll go back. And then I just kept shifting that by few years, till I just got used to it. And then going back was not an option.
Okay, going back was not an option. Now, what sealed it? What told you going back is not an option?
Because I think, again, in Dubai, I would just be dealing with problems of the richer people, right? I might be minting money, and you are just investing in, you know, building more luxurious real estate. You are investing in more tech that, you know, someone is doing, and you're just trying to make money on money, right? That's all you do. I thought that I found meaning here, because some of the problems we were solving, one of the companies that I was on board for 8 years, they were dealing with issues of anemia. And with them, I visited Palghar and Melghat district, Gadchiroli district. There is a gentleman named Dr. Abhay and Rani Bang who work in Gadchiroli, and they brought the, you know, newborn death, neonatal mortality from 130 to 30, right? Which was an amazing work that they did. And I spent 3, 4 days with him, spent time with him, and you say, okay, this is real. This is real change that you are able to bring. Like that, I saw many such examples. I saw entrepreneurs looking at problems and trying to solve the kind of innovation that was happening, right? If you look at education today, the issues that I encountered, I was bad in math, bad in science. I could not go home and ask someone that, can you teach me, right? Some of the more complicated concepts. Lot of friends around me, they couldn't go to home and ask someone. They couldn't pay for tuition. If you went for tuitions also, I mean, you really didn't get it. And here I saw entrepreneurs really addressing those issues, right? Experiential learning. How do you teach maths in a more simple manner? I found a company that I invested in that was looking at it. Same thing in science, same thing in English. In healthcare, I saw when, you know, my mother was in hospital, you know, how broken the health infrastructure. My daughter was born in a trust run, and I saw, you know, children almost dying because of, you know, hypothermia that was not needed, anemia that was not needed, right? That was, I mean, these were things that you could really solve for. They could not be causes for death. And you increasingly saw issues like diabetes, cancer. If you are in Mumbai versus Gadchiroli, if you have cancer, you don't detect, you know, what you detect stage one, you detect stage three, right? So that delta, that inequality is much, much bigger. You look at issues of farmer, someone who is near Pune versus someone who is living in Chhattisgarh or Jharkhand, where there is no, you know, market nearly. So you saw, I mean, that inequality I saw around, and I said, you know, this is far more meaningful way of living my life than going to Dubai and working for some very wealthy family and then trying to make more money for them.
Fine. So you saw all these issues. You saw agriculture, you saw healthcare, you saw education. These were prime areas. Agriculture, they say, is the backbone of our country. Healthcare, the need of every citizen here. And education is where the base or the grounding of every little child is. And I love it that you brought the concept of inequality. It is real. Not many people talk about it. Did you see where the two can meet and how you can use both of them and build something around it? That is how the journey began. Where and when was Mentera born?
Mentera was, at least the concept of Mentera was born in my mind, very first investment job, where my you know, one of my mentors asked me this question that it's a cliched conversation, but it was very moving conversation for me, where he said, you know, 10 years from now, what would you consider success? What do you think you will be doing? I was surprised how quick I was with that response. I didn't have to think. I told him that, you know, I would be running a fund in India, which will be solving issues in education and healthcare. And he asked me, he said that, you know, can you give it more thought? This is very impulsive. This is not impulsive, what I want to do. And he said, why don't we have that conversation again tomorrow? And next day, I still remember, I have that chart with me, PowerPoint, where I drew, you know, what kind of a business I would be running, what issues in education, what issues in healthcare, what will it look like, all of that. And I gave him a structure, and he said, you know, you were not only just imagining, you have got the detail around it. I said, yes. And then he said, then why are you in Dubai? And what are you doing here? And I said that, look, I mean, I know nothing about investing. Nobody knows me. Who will give me money to do it? So I think that's when the thought and the concept was born. When I came to India, I thought 8 years of investing and all, now people will trust me. I have CFA, I have CA, I have done investing, but people ask me that, what do you know about this? You've never invested. And you know, you worked in investing, but it was not, you were not taking decisions. Someone else was taking. You didn't raise money, right? So many of the things that you need to do in investing, I had not done. It was a fair question. So nobody wanted to give me. And I worked in Willgrow, which was an incubator, and I met with a couple of colleagues. One of them told me that, you know, I was still an advisor, and he said, what will it take for you to do this full time? I said, I want to do a fund, and you know, someone gives me money, I become full time. And then he said that, why don't you join me full time, and I give you a commitment, in 2 years' time I'll raise money for you, and through my network we'll do it together, and then on the basis of performance maybe you get more money. It was very credible, genuine offer that he made, and I told him yes then and there. Then we started it, and he lived his side of the bargain, helped me raise money. That's how our first fund started.
It's such a beautiful case, Mukesh, of just being pure in your intention and just pursuing that. And the universe has a way of you meeting the right people at the right time for things to start growing. So, do you think that's how it happened with you, or were you very clear that, okay, this is what I'm going to talk about till I find somebody who trusts me?
Not talk about, I actually meant it, right? So I was not only talking about it, I wanted to do it. And I was seeking people who would help me do
Yeah.
it.
But
And
how did you choose the people you're going to talk to?
it was all accidental. I still remember that, you know, there was a recruiter who reached out to me. Founder of Wellgrow was looking for someone who had investment background who could do this. Because till then they were receiving grants, giving grants. You know, discipline of investing, discipline of business, how do you bring it together? So he was looking for someone, and the recruiter called me saying that, would you want to work for this not-for-profit? And they were talking about poverty alleviation, base of pyramid. And I didn't understand base of pyramid. I didn't understand poverty alleviation. I said no to her. And she called me a couple of times saying that, why don't you just go and meet him in Chennai? They will sponsor your flight ticket and all. Why don't you just go and meet him? I was sitting, and you know, my wife asked me this question, what do you have to lose? They are sponsoring your ticket, just go and meet him. And I said, look, Chennai, and you know, this is not making sense to me. I want to run a fund, and this is something else. And when she asked me, what do you have to lose? We're just sitting here free, figuring out what to do with life, just go and meet him. And then I said, yeah, I've got nothing to do. So I went here, went there, and I spent a day with him. And at the end of the day, I still reached the conclusion I didn't want to. I told him, we can't. You are talking about, you know, running some philanthropic organization, poverty alleviation program that doesn't align with my investment, because I want to use the power. I was not thinking about base of the pyramid and poor and how to help. I was thinking about issues in education for middle class, lower middle class. I didn't have vocabulary for it, but it seemed like by that time working in, you know, very capitalist world, you thought about, you know, this colleague of mine grew up in Kerala. And you could see all the socialist thinking there, right? So I was thinking these binaries, that he's thinking socialistic, I'm thinking capitalistic, never going to. And he called me 15 days later in a very humble way, he said, can you, walk outside of these ideological boxes you have created? And he said, you think that capitalism works? And this was 2 years after 2008, right? So he said, you guys almost brought the whole world down. So just trying to make more money from the money. So why don't you use that money to do something good? And I'm not asking you to do philanthropy. Just figure out how to do the fund, but figure it out with. I was still very circumspect. And he said, why don't you give me 15 days of time for 6 months? And in this 15 days, you'll not ask me any questions. Whatever tasks I give you, just do it. The end of 6 months, you tell me, did you like it enough? And that's how it started. It was him pushing me. It was, creating conditions where, my doubts didn't come in the way. I didn't have to make a full-time commitment. And I think those 6 months, I met enough entrepreneurs. I met enough people who were solving meaningful problems where I thought, okay, this is not too far from the fund that I wanted. This was not exactly that, but not too far. There is a way to really figure it out. So again, I don't think I would like to take the credit that I found the person. It was again universe conspiring to put me in the right place.
So here comes the concept of taking up that responsibility, a kind of trust issue. Clearly, the universe was conspiring, but it is also giving you the lessons parallelly on how to go ahead and putting you in a meeting with the right people who are teaching you what you needed to know. So when you talk about inequality, yes, did this idea then start getting its roots from the people and conversations you were having to get the clarity of what you set out for and what it is today when you're talking about Mentora?
I think, again, like many things, it's been a discovery, and sometimes seeds are sown somewhere and then, it happens. So I think this concept of responsibility, concept of trusteeship, being in custody of something, that seed was sown in childhood by my grandfather. And then, the work that I did, it was an event, that incident that happened where, like I told you, I used to read these magazines. And I knew exactly which day, what time that magazine arrived. And I would just run to my father, ask him for money, and just buy it and start reading. And one day my father was not on the shop. So I took his cash counter, I took that money out, and I went and bought that. I forgot to inform him. And end of the day, he was accounting for whatever, income, expenses, cash. And there was 10 rupees missing. And he was perplexed, where did the money go? And usually you think, did someone come and take it out, right? And so then my grandfather just asked him that, who all came to the shop? And of course, I was one of the suspects who could have taken it. So he called me and he said, did you take 10 rupees from here? And I said, yes, I did. He said, how can you? He was speaking in our mother tongue. What he said, ki aapne chori ki. He said, I was just completely taken aback. I said, if I take money from my father, it was like I was taking from my father. Like, ye chori hai. And I said, I asked him how. And he said, first of all, that money belonged to the shop, doesn't belong to your father. And your father's money doesn't belong to you. He said, if he decides to give it to you, then it's yours. After he has given it to you, when he has given it to you, it's not yours. As a child, I was very disturbed because now I am called thief. And I dealt with that for several days, saying that, did I do something wrong? And then, of course, once I got older, I had the opportunity to have the same conversation. And then he elaborated on it and I understood some parts of it. And then you start working in investing, where they talk about concept of trusteeship, being in custody of someone else's, and you understand that. And then recently I read a book that was written by Jerry Rao, who's founder of Emphasis. He talked about, where did Gandhi understand this, which was temples in the temple. And, how did Gandhi, learn more about it? And he gave many examples. What is the concept of trusteeship? And for the first time, and I think after the last few months, and I spoke with Jerry Rao also, had the good fortune of meeting, is when I understood that we use the concept of trusteeship very narrowly. Like in case of, company, you will say maximizing shareholders' return. You are still being a trustee, right? It's your shareholders' money. And your investors' money, you're maximizing it. You're not thinking about the product you are selling. You're not thinking about the customer who's buying it, the quality you are selling. If I'm taking from a poor person, you know, a fee of 500 rupees a month to teach that person's child, if I don't give a good product, I've not done right by that. So the concept of trusteeship extends to that also, right? So in a business context, I think this concept has to be thought more holistically then. And that, I would say, is a new discovery for me. Last 6 months, and I hope to do better on this concept. I don't think I've done full justice with it as yet, but I hope to do better.
Mukesh, if you can share at this point those reflective moments in your journey, I think it'll be amazing to see how far off the ground you have covered.
I grew up in a very right-wing environment, right? In a state where I grew up, the kind of era that I grew up in. And over time, I realized that I didn't want to be in any extreme, left or right. So that is one thing that I would talk about. And growing up in Dubai, I ended up being very good friends with a gentleman who was half Pakistani, half Brit, very devout Muslim, and we explored, our religions. Him asking me about mine, I asking him about his, we talking about our countries. So I think the only thing I would say is, my wife's family, the intellectual, stimulation that I get from her support over the years is something that, she being behind me like a pillar, right? Because it's not been an easy, a very topsy-turvy life. And she's a Kannadiga, I'm a Gujarati. So she comes from a family like her, her great, I mean, some generations ago was assistant of Sir Vishveshwaraya. So they were engineers who built this KRS dam, right? So she comes from a very educated family, first generation. So them accepting me into the family, accepting this marriage, she being with me and two beautiful daughters. We can talk about that and all of this making me a better person. My daughter's asking me questions. Both my daughters keep telling me. They didn't understand the meaning of word mentira, which is land of mentoring, mentor plus terra. When they came to office, we didn't have enough women. Younger daughter kept asking me, can you change your company's name to Women Terra and can you have more women in it? And Terra is not. it's all men there. Like it. So like that, conversations with them makes me better human being and a much more richer person, right? People around family, the kind of people I've met, not only family, like I said, this person, and there have been so many of them. I can't say there's one person. I can probably, if I put together a list of people, must be, we'll get closer to 100. I don't think it'll be a small number of people that either help, nudge, shape something or.
And where do you see you and Mentora go from here?
Increasingly, I have this. This is something again. I growing up, you hear this Karmani Vadi Karaste.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think I am increasingly getting more and more comfortable with this. Earlier, I would chase a goal and I would get very disappointed if I didn't get it. Like I told you, in my life, I've had many such disappointments. Right. You have to keep trying to get it.
Yeah.
Now I think I want to focus more on effort than on goal. And then I think, like everything else in my life, universe and the person who has created the universe decides what happens to that effect. So I don't know where I will be at. These are all means to an end.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think the attitude of being a true karma yogi, of doing what you have to do and live with that detached attachment with the results is what I can see from what you're saying. And that's a beautiful.
I'm not there yet. I think I'm practicing it. I think it'll take some time. I'm not there yet.
That's okay. As long as the journey and the pursuit is in the right direction. So when you are trying to be there, there were challenges which came to the whole world. And in 2020, it was the pandemic. So everyone took a step back. And where were you and where was Mentor at that point of time? And what were some of your reflections from the pandemic?
Yeah, I think it shook like us. It like everyone, it shook us completely. It shook me as a person. It shook Mentira. Many of the companies that we invested in, some of them almost shut down. Two actually shut down. Some went to the brink and then came back from the brink. Mentira also almost shut down. Mentira also went to the brink and came back from. So that actually made me more and more comfortable with not really focusing on results. I think a lot of people came for help again. We had a couple of investors who stood very strongly. And they said that, you know, no matter what, you're not, I mean, whatever it takes to keep it alive. There's a foundation in US and there's a family office in London and Switzerland. I think two of them. And then there were some colleagues, some people around who said, you know, this effort is worth going, keeping going. A lot of entrepreneurs who also didn't give up that space. And I would say I could see really resilience in them. And one of our companies actually created a lot of COVID-related solutions. The first COVID wave, almost one third of the, you know, diagnostic tests were carried out using their products. So that made me feel good that, you know, we have done something meaningful here. And despite that, you can see the vulnerability that many of our companies had, we had, and we were able to deal with those vulnerabilities and come out of it. We didn't come out of it fully. You had, you know, many scars all over the body, but then it makes you stronger, right? It makes you stronger. And I think COVID, if anything, it taught us that, you know, the way we live, the way we think about our life, work, our money, all of that has to change. I think at least for me, that discovery began with earthquake, and COVID just completely sealed it. So a lot of people, I think it is begun, and I hope that there are going to be more and more people who will think about their life, their work, their money differently.
Yeah, that's so true. COVID was a huge leveler. Everyone had to go back to the starting point, immaterial of where you were in life, and restart a lot of your thought, right from your thought process, the way you led your life, the way you thought about life, and
yeah,
also the fickleness of life itself.
Yeah,
I think it was a huge shaker for a lot of people who were living in a dream bubble. And so the three-pronged approach that you have in Mentira of education, agriculture, healthcare, is a fourth prong coming in, or as of now, you're going to stay focused only on these three areas?
We keep debating it. These three are very big, and we are actually within these three also getting into very specific things, not education. Within education,
okay,
if there is a poor child, how do you give good quality education to them?
Yeah.
So the cost of education, access to education, right? We are actually getting more and more specific within these three. Outside of these three, there are two themes that bother me, but I don't think I understand enough to go at it right now. But we are experimenting some things. Climate change is one of them. And
oh,
there is a lot of hype. There is a lot of, you know, everyone really going after the, you know, flavor of the season. And there's a lot of like impact washing has been happening. You see now gender washing and green washing happen, right? Everybody talks about it, takes money for it, but doesn't do right by it. So we want to be careful not to really jump into it. So that is one. And gender inequality is the other one, which I think I have seen in with very, I mean, I'm not the affected party, but I have seen even
yeah,
in the privileged class,
yes,
you know, women around me. And in the early days, I didn't see it enough. Now I see it more and more. And I have two daughters. So when I think about them and their life, I worry about it more than I used to. So that's another thing that, whether Mentira does it or not, that's something that I feel. I mean, we worry about it. We funded women entrepreneurs, funded issues of women. But I'm saying, will Mentira become gender focused, completely gender focused fund? Maybe, maybe not. But at individual level, I think it affects me enough to think about solutions or to support someone else who do.
You know, in fact, what you spoke about climate change, That is definitely affecting two areas that you are working in, agriculture and healthcare. And climate change is real. We can see the new health challenges that are coming in and how it's affecting nature per se with the climate change and the produce that we're getting, the yield that we're getting. So they are all definitely interconnected. And I'm sure Mentera will find how the connections of all of this
So
meet.
already dealing with it, I have very good examples, but today we'll run out of time. Very good. I've seen farmers taking a hit directly. Very specific crops, you know, how the seeds need to change, how the farmers are getting affected. So we're already dealing with it, but we have not talked about it in as much because I think, like where Mentera was 5, 6 years ago in education health, I think that's where we are. Once we figure it out, we'll talk about it with more conviction and more, I would say, data and evidence. Anecdotal, I can talk to you even, but it would not be. I mean, it would. We could probably be also doing green wishing and green washing and gender wishing and gender washing. Not doing enough of.
Because recently I was listening to a podcast about this, that where is the next investment in and the next market, and everyone said climate change because that's real and it's showing up in the way people's health is turning out, the food we are eating, everything is getting affected. So people are waking up to climate change. I'm so glad you are thinking on those lines. For the good work that you've done so far, I'm sure if people like you get into the space of climate change, there will be real work on the ground. Like you said, there's a lot of washing happening, but how much of it is getting cleaned or is it just wasting of water? Time will tell us. But when genuine people get into that space, I think that's where the issue gets addressed. So best wishes there. But before we leave, Mukesh, three life lessons that you would like to leave us.
I think I can tell you the quotes that have inspired me, and maybe there is lesson there. One is I had visited Arvind Eye Hospital, spent some time with the founding team there, and when you walk in, there is the founder's, you know, quote there, which says, "Intelligence is not enough. There must be the joy for doing something beautiful in life." Right? So otherwise, you know, whatever intelligence you have, money you have, whatever resources, network, whatever, you know, that God has blessed you with, is not, there's no value in it. That's one thing. People realize early enough in life, then they do more within this time. Second, I would say that, you know, we have grown up hearing about, you know, men are born equal, Abraham Lincoln's famous speech and all. And women, they are not born equal, they don't die equal, they don't live equal. Right? We create many, many barriers. Social, political, economic, religious. We create so many excuses to accentuate the inequality. And when we try to address it, we accentuate it. So I think recognizing the inequality and working towards it, and at the minimum, don't contribute to it. Right? You may not be able to deal with it, you may not be able to resolve, or you may not be able to do much towards resolution. Don't contribute. Is what I would say is the second thing. Third is this is something that inspired me where you said that, you know, what gave you inspiration. So there are two things. One, there's an English, you know, thing that I read as a student, and there is a song. So both of these are part of the same thing. So it's work for the night is coming when man works. Right? So that's one that I think is. The Hindi part of it, Ruk Jana Nahi, Tu Kahin Aa, right? So both of these, I think, have been my, when I'm down, if I just listen to this, just read it, some magic happens, few minutes, and then all the disillusionment, all the skepticism, all the, you get tired also, keeping on trying everything together. So I would say those are the three things.
And the line "Ruk jaana nahi tu kahin haar ke," then how does it go further?
कांटों पे चल के मिलेंगे साए बाहर के।
साए बाहर के, सो ओ राही
थोड़ा है।
एंड ऑल ऑफ अस आर डेफिनेटली ट्रेवलर्स इन दिस जर्नी कॉल लाइफ, एंड दैट साए बाहर की इज व्हाट वी आर ट्राइंग टू रीच आई थिंक इन आर जर्नी एंड द प्लेसेस वी आर ट्राइंग टू स्टॉप टू टेक दोज पॉजेस. मे दिस ब्यूटिफुल इंटेंट जस्ट कैरी ऑन. द लाइफ लेसन दैट यू लेफ्ट अस विद इज वेरी पावरफुल. And I think honored to have had you on You and I with Rashmi Shetty, Mukesh. God bless you. All the very best. And the purity of intent is what touched me. And I'm so glad we had this conversation because somewhere I feel when the purity is untouched, the reality becomes something that people dream of. So stay blessed and continue doing the awesome work that you're doing.
Thank you for inviting me. It was nice talking to you. Thank you.
Likewise, Mukesh. Take care. With that, we come to the end of this weekly quest of You and I with Rashmi Shetty. Do let us know if you know people who make the world beautiful. Write in to rashmi.thethirdeye@gmail.com. That is rashmi.thirdeye@gmail.com. Come, let's explore this amazing world together, both you and I.